to Matthew, the 13th chapter. Jesus put before the crowds another parable. The kingdom of heaven may be compared to someone who sowed good seed in his field, but while everybody was asleep, an enemy came and sowed weeds among the wheat, and then went away. So when the plants came up and bore grain, then the weeds appeared as well. And the slaves of the householder came and said to him, "Master, did you not sow good seed in your field? Where then did these weeds come from?" He answered, "An enemy has done this." The slave said to him, "Then do you want us to go and gather them?" But he replied, "No, for in gathering the weeds, you would uproot the wheat along with them. Let both of them grow together until the harvest, and at harvest time I will tell the reapers, 'Collect the weeds first and bind them in bundles to be burned, and gather the wheat into my barn.'" Then he left the crowds and went into the house. And his disciples approached him, saying, "Explain to us the parable of the weeds of the field." He answered, "The one who sows the good seed is the Son of Man. The field is the world, and the good seed are the children of the kingdom. The weeds are the children of the evil one, and the enemy who sowed them is the devil. The harvest is the end of the age, and the reapers are angels. Just as the weeds are collected and burned up with fire, so will it be at the end of the age. The Son of Man will send his angels, and they will collect out of his kingdom all causes of sin and evildoers, and they will throw them into the furnace of fire, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Then the righteous will shine like the sun in the kingdom of the Father. And anyone with ears, listen." The Gospel of the Lord.
Praise to you, O Christ.
A wise man was once asked, "Can you describe the difference between a neurotic and a psychotic?" The wise man responded this way: "The neurotic is the one who builds castles in the sky. The psychotic is the one who tries to live in those castles." Today, our focus is not in living in castles in the sky, but looking at how we live here on this earth. Common among the many religions in the ancient world was the belief in the earthly appearance of a divine being from an outer or upper realm apart from the earth. This being descended to earth and brought about the transformation of the world. People believed that they would participate in the life of this divine being, and in oneness with the divine being, people could conquer the dread of one's fate and conquer one's fear of death. This victory over the dread of one's fate and over the fear of death was accomplished because the divine being that came to the earth took fate and death upon himself. Now, one of the religions in the ancient world alongside of Christianity was that of Stoicism. One practitioner of Stoicism named Epictetus spoke of this particular school of thought by saying, "How great the benefactor that shows the way, who has discovered and brought to light and communicated the truth to all, not merely of living, but living well." Now, for the Stoics, there is one human attribute that is above all others that leads people to be able to live well. And it was another Stoic philosopher named Seneca who was heard to say that this one attribute was worth all the rest of virtue and attributes together. And that attribute was reason, a capacity for a person to think logically and come to a rational conclusion. Universal reason was the attribute of the divine being to which the people were connected. Reason as a divine attribute in which all humans can then fully participate. So through reason, a human being can prevail over all human desires and fears. A person can transcend all one's own passions and anxieties. And the anxiety about one's fate and the fear of death can be overcome by participation in reason. And speaking about fear, then, the Stoic philosopher Epictetus states, "For it is not death or hardship that is a fearful thing, but the fear of death and hardship." He claims that the fear of death and hardship lead people to put a mask over other people, objects, and situations. This mask, then, that we hear about leads to the next question, which is, so how does one make the fear disappear or the suffering go away? And the answer to them is simple. One removes the mask. And once the mask is removed, the fear disappears. You see, it's the human capacity to think, to process, to be reasonable that gives them the capacity to unmask and overcome their fear and their hardship. A number of years ago, when my family moved into our new house in Landisville, the house is designed that at one end of the house is the master bedroom, and then there's a hallway that leads out into the kitchen, and along that hallway is a door that goes out into the garage. I had never in my life ever had a refrigerator that had an ice maker in it, but in this new house, the refrigerator had an ice maker, which caused great problems the first night that we stayed in this new house. I'm laying there, I'm relaxing from having done all the moving into the house, and all of a sudden I hear these strange noises coming back the hallway. I started to get scared because I didn't recognize those noises, and I knew that the garage door was like right between, and I thought someone was coming through the garage and was getting ready to come through the garage door and come right into the bedroom and get us, and I was laying there terrified. And finally, when I convinced my wife to go see what the problem was, it would not be the first time I asked her in the middle of the night to go check something out. I may not be courageous, but I am intelligent. She discovered it was the noise of the ice dropping from the ice maker into the bin. But as soon as that mask was removed and we knew what was happening, so too was the fear gone. That's what the Stoics would teach us, that we had this capacity to unmask and get rid of the fear. Now, this capacity for reason that allows a person to unmask and overcome fear and hardship is believed to be universal. But according to the Stoics, it only appears to be an attribute of a limited number of people. Not everyone shows that capacity. The rest, they would claim, are fools who are in bondage to their desires and their fears. In addition, those with the attribute of reason do not believe that they do things that are wrong, for they have control of their desires and passions, and so their desires and passions, being disciplined, never lead them to do anything morally wrong. Epictetus himself states, "I've maintained that which is under my control. I have never done anything that was wrong in my private or my public life." I know that as I look upon the congregation here that I'm speaking to people who are in the same camp, and that is that people who are so disciplined, they've never done anything wrong. But think about other people outside of the congregation at this point. So this capacity, this through reason to overcome one's passions and remove the mask of fear and refrain from engaging in that which is wrong, this capacity is called renunciation. It is to renounce those desires. It's the conscious decision to refrain from engaging in that which might bring about harm, instill fear, or lead one away from wisdom. It's important for us to pay attention to schools of thought that were present generations ago, because these schools of thoughts, they bubble up on occasion in the newer generations. Now, we may not use the word renunciation, but in today's age, we use the word abstinence. That is refraining from doing something that's harmful. And we believe that if people had that discipline, then we wouldn't have the problems that we have now. So we claim that if people would just stop using opioids, we wouldn't have this epidemic that we have now. We claim that if people would just stop drinking too much, we wouldn't have a problem with alcoholism. We tell people that if they just stop thinking negative thoughts, they wouldn't have to fight depression anymore. And I see that this next one play out repeatedly as I visit couples who have someone who is fighting dementia. You know what I hear that loved one say to their partner repeatedly? Don't you remember? Try to remember. Don't you remember? And if somehow that person could will themselves to fight that disease and to remember. It's important for us to reflect upon this school of Stoicism, because it was a prevalent approach to understanding self in the world at the time when Paul wrote his letter to the Christians in the city of Rome. Seneca, the prominent Stoic philosopher that I quoted earlier, was living in Rome at the time that Paul wrote this letter to the Christians in the city of Rome. And just shy of two decades later, Epictetus would be born in Turkey, but as a young age, move into Rome and then teach in that place. So they were firmly ensconced in the concept of renunciation. But Paul, in his letter, challenges the notion of renunciation. He challenges this by stating in chapter 7, about verses 7 to 25, he says that humans can will what is right, but they can't do it. And he goes on to become more personal and more vulnerable as he writes, "When I want to do what is right, it seems like evil is close at hand." This incapacity that Paul would say that we have for renunciation, it's a weakness of ours. He calls this incapacity living in the flesh. And this living in the flesh is a condition into which all people who are born of women — I'm pausing so you grasp the fact that we're all born of women — it's a condition into which we are all born. Paul contrasts this living in the flesh, then, with living in the spirit. And he says that the dilemma in which people find themselves is not that of lacking enough willpower and reason for renunciation, but the dilemma is that we do what is wrong in spite of ourselves. So in juxtaposition to this cosmic renunciation held by the Stoics, Paul speaks of cosmic salvation. The capacity to transcend the fear of our fate and the fear of death. The capacity to transcend that which masks people and objects that lead to fear. The capacity to discipline oneself is not a matter of virtue, self-control, or even doing the right moral thing. The capacity to transcend these things, when it's about cosmic salvation, the capacity comes from forgiveness, not renunciation. And further, he goes on, in opposition to the Stoics, this gift of salvation through the forgiveness of sins is given to all people and not just to a select few. A lot of my television viewing time over the last 3 weeks has been watching the Tour de France. I'm not getting up early in the morning to watch it live. I'm watching the rebroadcast later in the evening. But having been a biker for a number of years, I love to watch how they confront and face the challenges in front of them. And it appears, even as we sit here now, that Chris Froome will win the Tour de France for the fourth time, the third time in a row after 21 stages of a race. What is fascinating about Chris Froome is that he's a master cycler. And he's brilliant at time trials, which is what they had yesterday, about a 22-kilometer time trial, where he can just hunker down, and he actually left 2 minutes behind the person in front of him yesterday, and he caught them at the finish line. He's brilliant at time trials, but he's also brilliant at climbing. And so you put him on these steep climbs in the Pyrenees and the Alps, sometimes getting close to 17 to 19% incline, and he doesn't slow down. He just kicks in like a mountain goat and goes. The announcers love this guy, and they love lifting up how good he is. But what was fascinating was a couple days ago, as the riders were getting ready to finish a climb and finish a stage, Chris Froome cracked. And he wasn't able to pull ahead of the other riders and win the stage. He lost his energy, his strength, his momentum, and fell back. And the commentators were overwhelmed. He cracked. Even as brilliant as we can be, and as determined as we can be, and as disciplined as we can be, there will come a moment when we will break down and fail. And it's that moment that Paul's message resonates the most with us. You are forgiven. You are forgiven. What Paul believes, the depth of his soul, is that we are set right with God and with others and the world and ourselves, not through self-discipline, but through forgiveness. And the forgiveness comes to us through the grace of God, the very nature of God to have mercy. And this grace is revealed to us in the death and resurrection of Jesus. Making this claim, then, Paul can speak about suffering in a different way. And he writes about this in the beginning of chapter 5 of Romans. Having received the divine gift of grace, we can boast in our sufferings, knowing that suffering produces endurance, and endurance produces character, and character produces hope, and hope does not disappoint us. Hope is a dependent state, a dependent condition in which we live. But Paul says to us at this point, to convey that sense of dependence, is what is the best image he can use of God to show how we are dependent upon God? And the first thing he does is, instead of using the proper word for father, In referring to God, he uses the Aramaic word Abba, which means daddy. What an intimate and beautiful relationship that one has with the person that one can call daddy. It's the same noun of affection that Jesus uses in teaching us the Lord's Prayer, our daddy who lives in the realm of heaven. And then Paul says, if God is our daddy, we are the adopted children of God. You are the adopted children of God. I still remember that wonderful moment when we brought my son home from the hospital. People asked my wife how labor was for her, and she said it was great because we just went to the hospital and picked the baby out and brought him home because we adopted him when he was 3 days old from the hospital. I still remember he would be laying there in his crib or laying on the floor, and I would just look at him and become overwhelmed, just overwhelmed with how amazing I thought he was, overwhelmed with the joy that he was part of my life. He's a teenager now. Those moments aren't as frequent, but it's still there. A father who looks at a child with such adoring eyes. That's the God who has claimed you. The one that looks at you with such adoring eyes that this God won't hold back anything. See that you're forgiven, saved. Hope comes from the fact that God has claimed you and has made you His holy child. We are never going to be a perfect people. No matter how hard we discipline or try to focus our lives, try to keep everything in order and think about things in the right way, we will fail at times. But God doesn't expect our perfection. Because a God who forgives does not need our perfection to please him. God gives us the one thing we need, is the gift of faith, to hold fast to the promise that God has made to claim you as a divine child. So as we live in this world, on this earth, we live as people who are imperfect and yet faithful. Amen.